From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
I'm Andrew Richards.
And I'm Paula Andruszkiewicz.
And welcome back to Tech Ed. We're still here. We are talking to Paula again. So we're going to do this one in a layer after, well, you've already seen last week.
Yeah.
So there you have it. What are we talking about today, Andrew?
So we kind of got in some way into security talking to Paula in our last episode from last week that you could have aired and also saw it live.
All my random questions.
And lots of random questions. Yeah. And we're going to kind of do the defragtoolness of it and we're going to get Paula to show us some cool tools and scare the crap out of us about how easy it is to find passwords.
I will do
stuff.
My best.
Yeah. So let's get started. I mean, what's the big tools that probably people know about? What are the tool names that you use that mainstream, and then we can probably go into the more security-related rarefied ones after that.
So the first tool that is definitely worth mentioning, it's a PS exec that you can get from the SIS internals. Yeah. And PS exec can be used in a kind of mutual way. You can use it for a bad reason and also for the good reason. PS exec can be used, for example, to elevate yourself to a local system account, which is very useful because some of the places in operating system are protected from the regular administrator. Mm-hmm. And the regular administrator, I mean, it's just a regular account with a little bit more privileges than the user. A local system is a built-in account that allows for a lot of things.
I was saying that system is the administrator of administrator.
Something like that.
It's not really that way, but it's kind of a good analogy.
Kind of, yes.
I tend to, when I do that, I tend to make a command prompt so that every tool I then make from there inherits the systemness. And then, so you regedit and presses explorer, wherever you run from that point onwards, is running a system. So that way you don't really have to continually keep on using PSX to start yourself, yeah. So how do you actually tell who you are when you're logged onto Windows?
Well, very simply, I use Who Am I? And as you see, right now I log in as an administrator.
So is that built into Windows as a standard tool?
Yeah, totally. It's a built-in Windows tool, and it's running both on the client and on server operating systems.
Where is it on the hard drive? Is it just in the System32?
Yes.
So yes, I probably use Where, actually. It's saying Where.
Of course. You can use this, and then, of course, you can ask for the certain tool, yes?
Yeah. So where is it? So
ding. And here we go.
System 32, as you guess, yeah.
So it's a very simple method to check out.
So if you did the PS exec, your name's going to change, right? It's going to change from administrator to system, is it?
Well, yeah, but that very much depends with what kind of parameters you're going to run it, yes? So we can, for example, use the minus S parameter, and this is to elevate ourselves to a local system. Then we need to use the I switch, and the reason why we need to use it is because to be able to run the processes as a local system, you need to have them running in the interactive mode so that you can still be able to talk to them.
Yeah, so it kind of goes into a background desktop.
Isolation.
Yeah,
exactly.
Session, if you don't do that, okay.
And minus D, I'm going to run, and I used to run it because I like to have the local system command prompt running within a separate window.
Yep.
So if you run cmd.exe,
yep.
Then it allows you to run the command prompt. As you see, in my case, it's red. I decided to change the color just to make sure that when I'm doing something, whenever you are elevated to local system, sometimes you may just damage your operating system files.
So you just go into the properties of the console program because that console program now is writing to the system profile rather than the administrator profile?
Definitely.
That's how it works?
I set up the defaults, and technically, if you go to the defaults, you still see here that I changed the font because I like to have it big. I changed the colors, and I got a screen background, which in here it's red, and of course, font is white. So, and as you see in the back, I do have an administrative console that normally it's black background and white fonts, but I change it to gray because whenever you see the black color, I mean, it's really nice, but when you work a lot with the console, my eyes are kind of cannot really survive it.
Yeah. And so if you do a Who Am I Now in that system console,
yeah,
we get anti-authority system. So anti-authority is kind of like a reserved word, I suppose you could call it, or a reserved provider, is that the word for it?
Yeah, so it's a built-in account, and there are three built-in accounts in operating system that we can use. It's a network service, local service, and a local system. Local system is the most privileged one, and it's kind of funny whenever you are configuring services running on the local system account because you don't actually provide a password.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty special account, and whenever you run services on something else, then of course you need to provide a password over there.
Cool. So what else is in your tool arsenal?
What else? So It's actually a really nice place that we are in because local system account can access to something that is called LSA secrets. And LSA secrets allow us to see, well, the secrets, so whatever is in the secrets, particularly the secrets that I will show you in a moment, are the ones that are related to service accounts. Mm-hmm. And of course, the same story can happen whenever you've got a scheduled tasks. I'll show you the service accounts. They are both grateful because it's very easy to grab the passwords from the account that either the scheduled task or the service is running at.
So this is like the domain account that it's running as, for example, so it has access to the wire or something.
Yeah, exactly. Like SQL Server, for example.
Yeah.
Yes. So very often it happens that, and it's normal to run a SQL Server on a certain account, SQL Server service. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, what happens, which is kind of, even it's kind of unpopular, I think, to say it, but it's that statistics show whenever I'm at the customer side that this is actually happening, so I'm going to say it. It happens that SQL Server service is running on a domain admin.
No.
That means that whoever has access to the certain database server, this person being a local administrator, can elevate to local system and can grab the password of the domain admin's account.
So do you find that you see many SQL Server installations where they have the, I forget what it's called, but where you can run an executable from a stored procedure? Do you see that turned on very often?
Yes, XPCMD shell.
Yeah,
but not really, not right now. It used to be like that, but right now, no. Because the stored procedure, the XPCMD shell, is disabled.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. So scare us and show us a password.
So first of all, a tiny thing. I got a tool that is written by our developer. This is an SAPD tool. The funny thing regarding this tool is actually one of the session participants at TechEd approached me, and he said, "I came to you just to thank you for the tool." I'm like, "What kind of?" It's like, "SAPD, I really use it. It's really helpful." I was like, "But you know that you can use it for the bad and for the good reason." It's like, no, I know it perfectly, but I'm using it for so many years already. Thanks for that. And I was really surprised because this is a pretty simple tool, but it does the job.
Yeah.
No doubt. So let's begin.
Did you get the vibe that he was doing it for good, not evil?
Well. first of all, I'm going to open up the services MSC. And I got here the MS SQL Server 1. Yep. And it's running as an administrator. So it can be started, stopped, doesn't really matter. So this password of this guy, of course, it's stored within the registry. It's not in a clear text. It's in an encrypted way. But still, as long as we are elevated to local system, we're able to access its secrets. So let's try and let's see what kind of stuff we can get out of that. So first of all, what I will do, I'm going to use the SAPD. Let me minimize the console in the back. And here you've got the service, so MS SQL Server 1. So let me run it. MS SQL Server 1. And then I'm not able to get the secret for that account from the registry. And the reason why I'm not is because I'm not elevated to local system.
Okay.
So if I'm going to be elevated to a local system, let's do it one more time. Maybe I'll just copy that command. So merc, and then let's copy the certain command over here. So this command prompt is elevated to local system. Then I'm able to grab the password for that account in the registry.
Hey, dollar word.
Yeah.
I think it's in the top 5 passwords, isn't it? Out in the world.
If not number one, yes.
Yeah. I think, is it 123 or something, or ABC is the number one?
ABC 123,
That's just mind-blogging that people use that. But
you know, my kind of, I suspect that ABC 123, it happens, not because it's very simple, but it's, for example, appears in some books somewhere, like IT books, because it happens so often, yes? Yeah. And this one, I mean, people will not be familiar with the password, if not the Microsoft approach, like Microsoft courses and so on, yeah? So
well, I think with PA dollar word, this is slightly different, but it hasn't got the dollar signs for the S's.
Yeah.
That variant is very prevalent in instruction manuals, and people think,
exactly.
Oh, it's got a special character, it's got an uppercase and it's got lowercase. It gives me the 3, it's 8 characters, which is the default complexity or minimum length for a complex password.
Yep.
Passes the test, easy to remember, but
yes.
Easier to remember.
Yes, we were talking earlier about our most secure passwords that we use at home.
Yeah.
And I was saying how my most secure, I use the ASCII characters.
Mm-hmm.
But it's difficult because keyboards don't come with the right-hand keypad anymore. So it's getting harder and harder.
Oh, so you actually type Alt, then a...
Yeah, I do Alt and then a little something going on over there.
Nice.
I have seen a lot of people use the character for space, but it's not space. There's a number up in the 200 range that renders like a space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in all character sets, but it's not a space. It's like, I don't know, a thick space or something. It's designed for typography for a different variant width. And you put that on the end of a sentence and you don't see it, right?
There
and even if you think that, you know, you have a quote around it and go, oh, there's a space at the end.
Oh, it's this tiny.
But it's not. I've seen that used a fair bit. And also, it doesn't when you're doing trim operations on strings, it doesn't get trimmed off because it's seen as a real character.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So what else you got?
I get a lot. One of the things that is pretty interesting from the server perspective, I'm talking about IIS over here, is that there's a lot of built-in tools in Windows that allow you actually to get the password out of the accounts. Like, for example, AppCMD. And the reason why it is possible is because whenever you have the application pull within the IIS running on a certain account, here comes the question. Is it possible, for example, to take the server out of the network, so servers like it's totally standalone with no network connection, and still be able to run the website on a certain identity?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, of course, yes. And as we know, in operating system, we cannot do things anonymously. Think processes must start with a certain identity. And in such case, we are authenticating it against what? It's a domain account. So there must be passwords stored somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it is actually maintained by the service. It's called Windows Process Activation Service. And from that service knowledge, we're able to grab the passwords in a clear text as well.
Oh, cool.
Should I show it to you?
Yeah, show it to us, definitely.
Okay. Cool. So first of all, I'm talking about here. We've got within IIS. We've got a tiny thing with an application pools. I got here application pool running on the certain account. You see? So it's a defined account.
Is there any different level of security based on what type of application pool it is, or they kind of all fall into the same category here?
Well, within here, you can pick from the different types of accounts, built-in accounts, like, for example, local servers, local system, and so on.
Yeah.
The pretty interesting one is the application pool identity, so application pool identity, which is kind of awkward because it's like application pool runs on its own identity, which is its own identity.
Yeah.
So technically, application pool identity account, it's a special account that has the privileges similar to network service.
Okay.
And of course, we can check out that whenever we go, for example, whenever we impersonate ourselves into this account, we can check out whoami/o,
mm-hmm.
and that shows us our privileges. Or we can check out within the user rights assignment. You got also privileges defined over there, so you will know what the account can do. But here, I got defined custom account.
Yep.
And that means that credentials are probably stored somewhere. So let's dig in. First of all, what I would do. I'm going to open up the console, and let me maybe open up the new console. It's going to be a little bit better. And then I'm going to go to the Windows, and then System32, and then INetSRV, which is the place where configuration files of the IIS are stored.
Yep.
And over here, I got AppCMD.
Yep.
This is a tiny tool that is since like forever regarding the IIS manager.
Yeah, it replaces the old IIS6 VBS script.
Yes.
I can't remember what it was called, something.vbs.
Yeah, that was some time ago. I don't remember the name as well.
Unfortunately,
yeah.
I'm old enough to, yeah.
And I'm young enough not to remember that.
Yeah. AppCMD is used to control the metabase of IIS7 and above.
Exactly. The application host config, maybe I can show it as well because it's kind of interesting. If we go to the config file, you can go to Notepad. Application host config, and I'm going to search here for the name of the account because I know how it's named. Unfortunately, it's a character, Freddy Krueger. And here we can see the configuration of the application pool,
mm-hmm.
and we can check out the password. And as you see, we do have this name. It's like encrypted IIS Windows Activation Service Only AS Provider, and then we do have a string. But that string, it's known by someone who starts the process, which is going to be Windows Activation Service. Well, it's actually called Windows Process Activation Service, but in registry, it's stated as WAS. So this guy will be able to do it. Okay, so how we're able to pull this information and decode it? Well, actually, very easily. First of all, and let me go to this AppCMD, which was, let me search for it. Here we go. I'm going to move myself to the parent directory and AppCMD. And then we do have a couple of options. For example, I can list up pool settings, I will name the application pool that I've got. So in this case, going to be that set. It's just a simple name. And then I'm going to export the settings to as a text, and I want everything.
Yep.
Well, the syntax is, of course, like the appcmd says. So over here, if we go and have a look in a little bit detailed way, here we are able to grab
simple
the buffers.
Simple as that.
Yeah, kind of.
Wow.
Yeah, very simple.
I was expecting to see something else, you know, some still encrypted thing that you then have to go play with, not just something straight there at the command line.
Nope.
So, well, you're losing all trust in all my trust in Windows security. So, all right, what else can you destroy? So, what else can you find?
What else? Today I was talking about pretty interesting thing regarding the memory dumps, and I was really happy to do that talk. Because the talk was about, well, different security issues that we can encounter within the memory of the operating system. And today there was a premiere launch of the tool that probably everyone already knows. It's a Mimikatz. And this is the tool that is written by Benjamin Dolpe. And with his courtesy, we were able to play with the version that was kind of exclusive, that did not left any traces on the server that we were attacking. And what was the attack about? Well, first of all, we connected to the server, and we sucked all the certificates from the server, including, of course, their private keys, even though they were marked as not exportable. Mm-hmm. And we were able to check out, of course, what this certificate is about and so on. And there was we were not touching a disk. Everything was running purely through memory.
Yep.
And the code that I was executing within the session is actually pre-compiled, it's ready to go, but it was encoded within the base 64. And this is the new option that we've got. You want to see?
Cool, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So I need to change the machine because I got like a lot of stuff running over here. And I will need to go to the Windows client box. So this is basically the PowerShell script. And it's a pretty long script. It is thanks to, of course, Benjamin and Joe Białek. So these are two guys that are engaged within the Mimikatz and that script. But that tiny part that there is at the end is actually our job over here, that tiny piece of code. And here, this is the pre-compiled, encoded, encoded version of the Mimikatz. And here you see that there is this tiny parameter, it's a new thing, it's base 64. So what's going to happen is if I put here the computer name and the dump certs parameter, because invoke Mimikatz, it takes that as a parameter, then I will be able to get the certificates from the memory of the certain server.
So from this client machine, you're using, is it WinRM or something?
Yes, exactly.
To talk to the main controller.
It's definitely like that. So WinRM must be on.
Then on the domain controller, you are going to its certificate store.
Yes.
With this embedded code that's been only run in memory the whole way through.
Correct.
It's looking at the certificate store, finding the private key.
Grabbing it out.
And then it returns it to you over
through the console directly, yes. Without touching the disk.
Nice.
The previous version was saving certificates to the disk, but not anymore. So let me show you. Yes, yep. It's actually pretty nice. So first of all, I need to specify the computer name. And in my case, it's going to be WS12 or 2, and then DC. And dump certs. Of course, secured.tech, let me put the fully qualified domain name. And then I think we are almost done. I just set it up, so hopefully it's going to be working. Yeah, it is working. So what I did, I exported the certificates to the certs folder. We can check out, of course, as you see, successfully saved cert to the file and so on.
So the PFXs are the one with the private keys, is that right?
Yes, we do have a private keys, yes, available. Yep. Mm-hmm. So PFX extension is the one that contains the private key. And if we have a look over here, there is this. There are different icons. Maybe I can even enlarge it because I do have a zoom in here available. So let me like click somewhere, whatever, and then we got it. And the icon is different. Yes. Yeah? So one is the CR, and another one is the PFX. This icon, it is the statement that within this certificate there is also a corresponding private key.
Yep.
And if, and I am able to grab the private key, and this particularly for the local machine, particularly, here we go, where is this? This is this one within the local machine. So for the certain domain, if I will be able to grab the key, I'm able to decrypt the traffic that is going on in between the client and the server. So HTTPS, it's fine, and SSL/TLS, it's fantastic, but it's not really a vulnerability in technology. It's just the fact that I've got the keys.
So what level of user did you need from the client to the domain controller to run the, what access level did you need to then make that jump to get to the private key?
Yeah, so the thing is that, of course, I need to be able to access the server using WinRAM, as you said. So WinRAM quickconfig, it's the one to set it up. WinRAM, it's usually open within the current times on a server because administrators want to manage servers remotely. Of course, you need to be able to get to the server, yes, to log on to the server. So whatever the privileges to the domain controller you need, which is going to be probably the domain admin, yes?
Cool, okay.
To do it. But I would say it's not a shame because this is one of the parts of the attack. If you are able to grab the domain admin, then you can move forward and then maybe do some nasty stuff around, disappear. And for example, instead of being just a domain admin, which it's a, like, let's say, not really somewhat cool, then you can do a little bit more and you can move one step further.
Cool. So this does it for certificates. Is there any other type of thing of equivalent type of exposing of cryptography that you can do, maybe for Kerberos or any other protocol?
Sure, definitely. So like, for example, dumping the Kerberos tickets from the memory?
Mm-hmm.
Will it work?
Yeah, just can do that.
Sure. You got it. So, let me have a look. What are we going to do this? We're going to do this here, let's say. Uh-huh. Okay. So, I got a client box. And that particular client, I'm going to log in as administrator at the beginning. What the demo that I will show leverages one tiny problem, is that it happens that administrators within the infrastructure, they log on within the privileged accounts to the user workstations. Mm-hmm. And as long as this is happening, and unfortunately it's a pretty bad habit, then bad things may happen.
So it's like that small business where the support person is called over to someone's desk. They log in, try to fix some things, maybe install some software better or uninstall, reinstall, and then log off and walk away with the problem solved. So yep. Is that scenario, okay.
Yeah, and you know, that I would say it's a kind of cheap trick, but the cheap trick might happen, for example, if the user has no physical protection like BitLocker, TrueCrypt, and so on, then the user being just a user can become a local admin just like that. I can show you that as well, of course. And it's actually a pretty useful demo to follow because if you forget your administrative password, you can recover it easily, yes? And the user becomes the local administrator. And let's like really put this the simplest possible way how you are able to elevate yourself. Put something in a startup folder and then wait. I mean, there's going to be this beautiful day, the domain admin or whoever comes, and then whoever that is going to do with whatever privileges this person has from the startup directory, right?
Yep.
So just a tiny, tiny thing. Okay.
So before you jump forward, so what is a Kerberos token? We probably should explain what a Kerberos token is.
Yeah, so Kerberos token is a ticket. The token that you got whenever you are authenticated within the domain, and that ticket allows you to access services within a certain levels. And whenever you are logging on as whoever to the domain, the Kerberos ticket is cached in a memory. And this is one of these things that stay in a memory even if the user does not log off.
Mm-hmm.
And you can use it, of course, to access like shares, like a file share. And when you are logged on to the domain, whenever you get a file share, you don't have to log on every time you access the server A, server B, and so on.
So it's kind of like a caching metaphor, so you don't have to slam the domain controller for every single request. Like every file copy, you can just say, look, I have a cache token, you trust me for this period of time?
Yes, for 10 hours.
Mm-hmm. Is it from this location only? So is it tied to the machine you're on, or can you move it? Can you transport that Kerberos token somewhere else, or is it only valid in the context of that computer?
Well, you can transport it somewhere else, definitely, yes, as long as you export it. But when you log on, it is valid within the certain computer, you still need to log on somewhere else to the computer, so you still need to obtain the Kerberos tokens to the other machine.
Okay.
So this is the first thing. Second, of course, you can export it, and of course, you can assign it to yourself, but this is very uncommon behavior. User will not do it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going here as an administrator, and what I will do, I will just get the token because I'm logged on to the domain right now, and I will, for example, browse to the share. And I'm going to browse through some share that I've got somewhere, yes? And I got here some files, including the bat.exe file that we should not click on, but just some private data, some users' hashes that I exported
previously.
So
they might have a scripts folder on the server that they keep around for helping themselves maintain a PC, for example.
Yeah, could be. Hopefully to this shared folder there will be no write access, because otherwise somebody can put someone over there. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay, and the reason why I'm opening it, I click on the bat.exe. There is one registry key that is added to the registry, but that's not important right now.
That's for another day.
Yeah, that's for another day. Anyway, so we've got here administrator accessing that share. So what I will do right now, I will just sign it out.
So that was a domain administrator account, right? Wasn't the local administrator?
Yeah, this was a domain admin who is maintaining the user's workstation, yes? And of course, any kind of account that logs on, there's going to be the situation like that. But it's just a matter of, what do you care about? Like, do you care about the privileges of the domain admin or like just a domain user? And of course, we know it's going to be the domain admin, yes?
Yep.
Okay, and I'm going to log on as Paula.
So dot means local machine rather than the domain?
Definitely. It's a tiny shortcut. If you don't remember the local, the host name, and which probably, I mean, it very often we do not remember that, because sometimes it's just generated automatically and we're like, oh, it's a very long name.
It's a great way of logging in. If you've got an account called administrator and you don't want to get confused with the administrator on the domain, that's how you differentiate the two.
Definitely. And that's how I'm indicating that I want to log on locally. So I'm in. Mm. And then what I will use is actually still Mimikatz. So let me open up the command prompt. And I'm going to run it as an administrator, because to do it, you need to be a local administrator. And again, maybe it doesn't sound really catchy, but technology is technology. And to be able to what I'm doing, so grabbing the tokens from the memory, I need to have some the privilege that is called a debug privilege.
So if you weren't a local administrator, you could use this other tool you're talking about, find out, change yourself to local administrator, log off, log back on again, now have the administration token, and then you can do this this level of command prompt activity.
Okay. I'll show you in a moment how to become a local administrator if you are not the one. Yeah. Okay, so we've got, I'm just entering the folders for the Mimikatz tool. Here we go. And then I'm going to do privilege, debug. And this is a pretty important privilege that administrator has this privilege, but there's a tiny difference in between this and local system. Local system is like all the time accessing everywhere, everything with the debug privilege, and the administrator needs to ask for it. And that's what I just did.
By default, it's stripped from the token, but you have the permissions to add it to the token.
Yes.
So it's just a mission rather than elevation.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I just ask for it and I can do it.
And ProcDump does this the same thing. ProcDump has the same code in it. So when it starts debugging, it goes, I need the debug right, otherwise I can't attach to it. So literally the very first line of code is add the debug privilege to itself.
Exactly. Yeah. So secure LSA and then tickets. And I need to export it. Okay, very good. And what kind of stuff do I see here? So, I mean, there is a lot of mess, and walking through this, it's not really pleasant.
So these are all Kerberos tickets we're looking at?
Exactly, and Kerberos tickets for a machine and for the certain user account. And luckily, I got one. So still, you can see here that there is an administrator's token that I've got within the memory. But to be polite today, let's take one tiny, so CIFS, to access the file shares token that allows me to access a certain shares and the one that the administrators access. Before I use the tiny token, I would like to show you that it's going to work, basically, that I, first of all, KList is the tool built in Windows tool that allows us to list what kind of Kerberos tokens we've got. Mm-hmm. And because I'm local, I don't have anything.
Yep.
So this is the first thing. And still, I will do dir.
So in normal operations, as you work around the network and talk to SQL Server databases and stuff, your list of Kerberos tickets will just slowly grow up, much like the administrator would have been granted one to go to the share, right?
Exactly. And here you can see basically who was logging on the server. Of course, the ticket's going to be valid within the memory till the next reboot.
Yep.
Yes? Okay, so I'm going to browse the server. So WS2012, in my case, the C share, and I am not able to access it. Not a surprise, because I'm a local user.
Yeah.
So what I will do I'll take the administrator's token.
And you wouldn't be able to look at any share because a local user doesn't have domain credentials at all. So any share on the network, not just a domain controller, you wouldn't have access to, right?
Not at all, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So over here, what I will do, so we've got, I copied the name here of the token. So let me go to the bottom, and then I'm going to attach it to myself. So Kerberos, Ross, okay, PTT. And then I'm just going to put the name of the ticket. So .tech.kirby, because this is the name of the token, yeah? And then I've got that successfully submitted to my session. I will go to the other console, and here I'm going to do dir, and then I'm able to access the domain controller, sure. Yes, but because I am acting right now as the domain admin for the next 10 hours.
Nice.
Awesome. So you can do a lot of damage.
Cool. Well, that's quite disturbing.
I'm
Stay
sorry,
away
it's my job.
From my machine.
Yeah. So how secure do you feel in the current security environment? Do you feel that people's machines are at risk always, or do you think it's not really that, is this pessimistic?
No, it's not that bad. I mean, operating system security, it's amazing because there are so many components that are preventing such behaviors, yes? Like, for example, of course, I can elevate to local system if I'm an administrator. But I cannot, for example, elevate to local system if I'm a user, as long as there is no rootkit running that will allow me for that, for example.
Yeah,
yes?
It's a different story. I think rootkits have kind of died off, though. That
exactly.
You don't hear, or they exist and we're just not finding them.
Yeah.
But either way.
There is a subject that went down.
Yeah.
I mean, if there is a problem with a driver, then rootkit can still get in. But no, this subject is kind of dry.
I think,
dry.
did Stuxnet have a rootkit in it?
Stuxnet had a driver. I think it did. Yes, it is. Yeah.
Cool. Awesome.
You want to talk about how do you troubleshoot malware that might not be doing anything at a given time?
Well, it's an interesting question.
Is there a way to try to find out what you might have that's sleeping?
Well, yeah. There is one tool. Like, a simple answer. Autoruns will show us anything that is not digitally signed, that is not legal, not legit within Windows operating system. Things that are not digitally signed, either the producer of the software really does not care, or something is wrong. Mm-hmm. Because if you are putting signature on a certain piece of code, then you are responsible for the code, of course. So autoruns will definitely tell us what is wrong. Actually, maybe I can show you this, because that's going to be the best. We could talk about autoruns, or I can just show you autoruns.
Yeah.
And with
Mark showed us a couple of weeks ago that the new version came out during the conference.
Oh.
And so he added... What did he add? I should remember. I can't. But he added some new features to it. I know what it was. He added WMI auto entry points. It's a new attack vector that's coming up. So
it's nice that it's here.
Yeah, one more additional, they call an auto run extensibility point. So
awesome.
A new WMI tab.
Oh, okay. Awesome. So I don't have it yet. Mm.
Show us how you would go about filtering down maybe to stuff that's dodgy. Using an Australian word.
The dodgy. Yeah. Usually what can be dodgy is the services. And the reason why it's like that is because whenever you're running Windows, for example, 8.1 particularly, on the computer that is not with the UEFI, and there's this tiny registry key that is added that prevents loading the DLL that is not digitally signed, by default, on everything else, on every other operating system, like for example on my box, there is no checking for the digital signature whenever you run the code. Which is, I mean, I think it should be there, but what can we do? And you can put in a service, of course, whatever you want, because operating system at some point is not intelligent. Nobody will tell you that you are not able to run this tiny piece of code. Yes, it's dangerous. Mm. From the antivirus perspective, of course, you can get the message that there is a new service that is running. But on the other hand, if you intended to do something, like for example, you can do dir, and that's going to be what the server is going to do, just a dir. Is it malicious or not? Yes. Mm. And it is a custom piece of code. So within here, for example, all of the components that are not digitally signed are pink.
Mm-hmm.
And we can do, there's the PJ service. There's this school icon.
Yeah, nice little Jolly Roger flag. That doesn't raise any eyebrows, of course.
It's it indicates that whatever is there, it's good.
Have you found that most malware people tend to be lazy and don't put a publisher or a description on their code? Or is that kind of like a myth that the omission of it is... I mean, do people do that these days?
No.
They're still lazy?
Exactly. They just leave things like that. Exactly. Of course, they can cheat, and they can even sign it with some dodgy certificate. But of course, who cares? If you don't trust the publisher, then it's still not trusted up.
Yeah.
So, and I'm quite surprised, because sometimes it happens very often that the code is not digitally signed, and you've got like some cool tools from the known websites, and when you download them, they're not digitally signed. And I mean, should we trust those or no? We don't know. Of course, we can dig in to an executable, check out what is going on, test it out on a virtual machine, but doing this for every tool, I mean, so we should definitely pay more attention to signing the code.
I think it's still pretty rare that, I mean, Stuxnet was a good example of this, where
it was amazing.
A completely verifiable certificate authority was stolen, physically stolen through social engineering from whatever that place was, and they used this real certificate to sign the software. And so it was one of the very rare cases where people apply the effort to really hide it properly. But yeah, that's why I asked the question about people being lazy. You know, people don't even put the description in, which is like 2-second job in the RC file.
Exactly.
But then, and signing it is only another $100 certificate.
Exactly.
From a dubious company that you make.
Exactly.
It's quite laziness that's...
In case of Stuxnet, it was pretty interesting because there was a Realtek and JMicron engaged. And I mean, these are the brands that we know, everybody knows those, yeah? So there was, of course, big story standing behind it. But everybody trusted Realtek certificate, so that's why Stuxnet was able to run and to be able to run on a 64-bit operating system, which has this level that you cannot run unsigned code within the 64-bit operating system that is within the kernel mode, and so on. So,
do you think the world's moving more towards a 64-bit world these days?
Oh yeah. I mean, servers are only 64-bit.
Yeah. I think even in the desktop space, I think having more than 4 gig of RAM is pretty common, I'm guessing, now.
Very common. And what's the problem to run the 32-bit app on the 64-bit operating system?
Yeah.
Yeah, you still got WOW.
Still works roughly the same speed. It's really only the 16-bit apps. Well, it's not even 16-bit apps. It's 16-bit installers getting a 32-bit app onto the OS. And I know Aaron Margosis has a script for that, that can automate the whole thing and work it out for you. So there's not that many excuses left to run a 32-bit OS.
Not at all.
And particularly when you layer on the address range that you lose for your GPU and stuff like that.
Exactly.
You're wasting RAM on a 32-bit OS.
Yeah. So, and RAM is so cheap right now, so definitely.
What's a malware or a method that you've seen that you were just, wow, that was ingenious?
I like Stuxnet.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, it's kind of funny because Stuxnet was creating two additional local security authority subsystems. And when I'm talking about Stuxnet, sometimes I like to ask a question, like, what is wrong with this picture? And I show the list of the processes from the task manager, even that, yes. And then it's like, I mean, there is what's supposed to be there, like local security authority subsystem, there, check. Like client server authority subsystem, check. What else? And the funny thing is that Stuxnet was running for so many years on the pretty, like in the Iranian power plant.
It was years after that they found it. Yeah.
And come on, how can you not notice that there are two more local security authority subsystems running?
Yeah, I think are people hiding inside SVC hosts these days?
Yeah, definitely.
If people know there's 5 SVC hosts, and you just add one more DLL to one of them, you're not going to get it from a process count point of view.
No.
You're not going to get it from a name point of view because you're looking at the signature of the XE, not of the DLL. And I think... there's tools to check for that. Process Explorer has now a certificate listing for the DLLs within a process.
And there's list DLLs.
Yeah, list DLLs too. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well.
All right then.
What about this password?
You got to show us the elevation of the password.
Yeah, I just want to show you how to become a local admin, yes?
Yeah.
And hopefully...
Actually, I need this. It happened to my dad's machine. I mean, wiped it instead of actually working it out.
Easy.
You know what happened?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you the story, and I'll see if you... I didn't guess it. And so we got a pretty old router, a domestic firewall, plugged it in, and the internet went really flaky. And so... we're worried that, and then there's a huge amount of traffic coming out of the machine. We did a network monitor or something in Trace to work that out. And then all of a sudden, the password wouldn't work in to log in on any account.
Okay.
And it's like, okay, well, we had this really old, like 2005 Wi-Fi router. And we're going, well, I don't know how secure one of some of these older routers are. Can it be attacked? Can the firmware be changed? Can it be opened? And can then they attack this machine that considered the local network to be in their home zone, so relatively open.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought, all right. And then rightly or wrongly, we were going down the path of formatting it. And then the machine got moved to do that for some reason. Mm-hmm. And a different keyboard was plugged in.
Oh.
And the keyboard had broken. It had nothing to do with the fact that we just installed the router. The keyboard was not producing the right character for one of the letters in the password.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so you don't think to jump to hardware.
Not at all.
At all, right? And it just so happened that all the passwords that were being used happened to have the same letter in it, and whatever it was, like the A key or something, was producing D's or something. Bit was missing on the physical keyboard. And because this different keyboard was plugged in, the problem went away. So you get all paranoid about, well, this is an old router.
Exactly. Like,
oh, maybe an attack.
And then something happened.
Why was there all this traffic? And from the ISP logs. That's where it was from. It was from the ISP logs. They said you had all this traffic. And it had nothing to do with a virus or anything else. It had to do with a physical keyboard that just had
Everybody
gone bad.
Everybody gets
paranoid. Yeah, and you're trying to... I mean, yeah, it was an interesting troubleshooting exercise.
Especially you knowing all that stuff. You're like, what can this have? What could this be?
Yeah, completely like, over-engineering like, the whole
like
thing.
Well, I was
investigation.
Well, it was a really old router, and that's what I was worried about. I mean, do you have any opinion on domestic routers? Are they actually secure? Do they actually provide a firewall that has worth, or in general, are they compromisable?
Well, I would rather worry about the Wi-Fi that we are using, because Wi-Fi is a physical layer, yes? And to crack Wi-Fi, it's like, it's just a matter of time. Regardless if you're using WPA, WPA2, doesn't really matter. It's just a matter of time. It's brute forceable.
Mm-hmm.
So the stronger password you're going to use, the longer it takes to break it.
So that does require a certain geographic location, right? You're not really going to have some that person from the outside of the planet.
Or you can pay $17, if I'm not mistaken, within one of the internet service, of course I can give you the name, to be able to ask the guys to do it for you.
Ah.
It's a paid job.
Okay then.
Okay then.
$17, huh?
Yeah, or 19.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
All right. Affordable.
Well, affordable, exactly.
Right. So your home Wi-Fi, do you change your password all the time? Do you use a really strong password?
Really strong password, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And periodically we change it, so like once a year to be.
And when I come to visit, you just yell out what the password is to me.
No, sorry, then you're going to get the guest Wi-Fi. That we've got as well.
I have the same thing. I have two Wi-Fis. I have one for guests and one for me.
Exactly.
And the guest one is in the DMZ, and the my private Wi-Fi is behind a second firewall.
Yes, yes.
So. All right. Well, you're coming over to my house and setting up my Wi-Fi then.
All right. So, show us how to make a local administrator out of
a
nobody user.
Okay. So, yes, what I did, I'm going to reboot from there. You can do this from the USB stick, for example, mm-hmm. and you put the Windows installation files in the USB stick, and then you reboot. And I'm going to just restart. That's it. And what I will do, so right now I'm going to reboot from the media. And I'm going to enter the... No, why not? That's pretty interesting. Oh, let me see. It's just a Hyper-V presenting this way, probably. Media, let's see. File settings, let me see if I can actually reboot from the media. No, everything is okay. So let me see what was wrong. Maybe I can show you this on a different machine. Sorry for that. I will do this within this box that I've got. Okay, this is so much better. So I'm going to do the same stuff. Insert disk. And then I'm going to go to the here. And I'm going to do this within the ISO image, yeah? So it doesn't really matter. Could be this one, Enterprise.
So this could be a Windows PE disk as well as a Windows setup disk?
Oh, sure. No problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. So Windows I, and then I'm going to reboot. Very good. And then I'm going to open up the registry on the drive. The next thing, so this is the prompt for booting up from the CD-DVD. And the next thing that I'm going to do, at this point you can do like whatever. There are so many things, so many tricks kind of that you can use. I'm going to use the nice one. Because you can, for example, rename the tool that is called Utilman. And Utilman is the on-screen keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And on-screen keyboard normally runs on the top of the WinLog on screen, which means it's launched within the WinLog on privilege, and that's going to be the local system.
Okay.
And so the next thing, repair your computer. We're definitely repairing it. So troubleshoot, and then advanced options. And then you fire up the command prompt. And over here, I'm going to launch regedit, within which I'm going to add the load hive. And here, I need to go to the registry on the disk, whatever is that.
So currently, this is the registry of the CD that's booted. It's not the registry of the Windows that's on the hard drive.
Exactly. And if I change anything, it's going to be lost. So I need to go to the registry of the operating system, which is in Windows, System32, config. And then over here, I can jump to, for example, and launch, let's say, system, software. I'm going to pick software because I said that I would like to show you something interesting. Okay, open. And then I can just name it. Let's use the most popular name for naming, which is test. And then I got that hive over here. And I'm going to go to the Microsoft Windows NT key. Here we go. I'm going to go to the current version. And I'm going to go to something that is called Image File Execution Options. And this is the place.
The best and worst key in Windows.
Yes, exactly. The best and the worst key in Windows. And here, I do have a tiny
key.
Great
power comes great responsibility.
Yeah.
I'm going to create a new key. So I just deleted one, but I'll just recreate it to show you how does it work. So util-man.exe. So this is the on-screen keyboard, accessibility settings, and so on. And over here, I'm going to create a new string value that is called debugger. Yes?
Yeah.
Super easy. And the value is going to be cmd.exe. And the reason why I'm putting cmd.exe is because cmd.exe, it's not a debugger. And who launches first is going to be the debugger. So technically, debugger is going to debug utilman. And it's a CMD to debug utilman, which never happens.
This is designed for you to debug things. You're meant to put something like WinDBG there, and then because it appends the name of the first key onto the command line. So it would normally be WinDBG, which is what you typed in, and then say notepad.exe on the end or utilman. And then it's WinDBG is the process that starts the process on its behalf debugging it. In this case, command's just going to pop up and couldn't care less about utilman.
Exactly. So I just close it safely and continue. And my machine reboots really fast, so you will see it in a moment. On the WinLog on screen, this tiny, tiny circle that you've got, these are the accessibility settings. It's called ease of access, which is kind of ironic, I think, because it definitely provides
ease
that.
Ease of access?
Ease of access. And so this ease of access, when I click, then...
I'll trademark that. It's mine.
Here we go. It's a command prompt that is on the top of the WinLog on screen.
It's red, so it's system.
Yeah, it's a my color. And then, of course, I can do net user and whoever was here, like, for example, Paula, and specify whatever password, 123, and then I can reset it. Yes. So that's it.
All right, then. Thanks for joining us, Paula. That's
the
show
guys.
For this week. Secure your machines. Fix your Wi-Fi. You have very little time.
Never leave your machine untouched.
Never leave your machine unattended.
Don't let Paula on your machine. See you next week.
See you guys.
Thank you.